to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark Stay.
And I'm Mark DeVoe. And before we dive in, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Scrivener, the very best writing app on the planet, bar none. So if you haven't tried Scrivener yet, pop over to literatureandlatte.com and use the coupon code BESTSELLERXP to get your 20% off this incredible piece of software, which we love to death, and we'll never stop talking about it on this show.
We're converts. Well, I'm a convert, and there's nothing like a convert, as they say, you know. So, yeah, love it to bits. Was using it just today, and it's amazing.
Excellent stuff. Yeah. Excellent stuff. So, Mr. Stay, it's been quite a, we always say it's been quite a week. We should probably firstly congratulate our fellow nominees in the podcast awards. We were, as you may have noticed, a few months ago, two months ago, we were nominated for best podcast.
Shortlisted. That's the key word. Yes. I was at the Future Book Conference, which is the conference run by the bookseller every year, looking basically at the future of bookselling and publishing. And it's a very exciting conference. And I was on a panel there with my fellow nominees where we talked about podcasting and how publishers should be using podcasts and what benefits them, and it was absolutely fascinating, and they're a great bunch, and we didn't win, but the winners are very deserving winners. I did want to do I was hoping there'd be a camera on me, because you remember when Samuel L. Jackson lost at the Oscars for Pulp Fiction and he's he said some rude words, Mr. D. I won't repeat them on here. I was hoping to get a Samuel L. Jackson moment, but the cameras, there were no cameras there, basically. But no, it was a really, really, really good day. Met some brilliant people, some great podcasts. The podcast community is vital and healthy and leading the way, frankly. We are pioneers.
Yeah. Whoa, there you go. And so welcome to anyone listening to the show today who saw Mark in his rather snazzy jacket. You see, for me, not winning was obviously a disappointment, but what made my day was seeing you sitting on that panel in this. I don't think I've ever seen you in a jacket before, Mr. Stay. That was,
oh please,
you really did dapper up quite well, I thought.
Oh please, I was with grown-ups. They made me put trousers on and everything.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic stuff. So what else is happening in your world, Mr. Stay? Any other news to share? He says, the rather leading question.
That is a rather leading question, yeah.
I think we should have a drum roll for this. Maybe later. Have you got the drum roll? Actually, but on that note, before we do any time drum rolls, we are going to announce the winners of our De Monza competition later. So if you like the drum roll, you're going to hear it later. But this is actually more than drum roll worthy. And I think it needs a drum roll. Here we go.
Hang on. Let me just get the drum kit into place. I'm after 15 years and 3 months and 7 days, I'm leaving Orion Publishing.
My goodness me. Yeah. This is huge news.
It is a bit,
absolutely massive. Bloody hell. How are you feeling about that?
I'm excited, actually. I'm excited. Basically, there's been a restructure. And I've been made redundant, essentially, but I stepped up and volunteered for it because this is an opportunity to give me the time to do the kind of things I've had a long list of things to do for a very long time, not least taking this podcast to the next level. And as you know, we've got all sorts of plans for next year, really exciting stuff.
Absolutely.
Which would have been virtually impossible with the day job. And I shall be also writing like a fiend. So
I can imagine.
Yeah, so
I can imagine the beast being unleashed as we speak.
Careful now. It's kind of scary, but very exciting. And it just feels like the right thing to do. It's the right time. It's a great opportunity. And I've loved Orion. I've made really good friends there. It is like a family. We had a retirement party for another colleague the other night, and you know, we've all known each other for a very, very long time. We've all got these old connections. We've sort of lived, laughed, and cried together. You know, it's we've gone through the hard times and the good, and I don't regret it for a second. I've met the most incredible people, not just, you know, the heroes that I worship and I could name drop till the cows come home, you know, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones, just to name a few. Christopher Lee.
And half of Monty Python. Half of Monty Python, I think.
Yes, Michael. Michael Palin knows me. That's, you know, anyway. but apart from that, just, you know, I've been with Orion through the most incredible change in the industry since the Gutenberg Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been absolutely extraordinary. So yeah, I'm off basically till the end of the year, Christmas. I'm there till Christmas, and then come January, I'm officially self-employed, freelance, and fancy free. So yeah, wow. Yeah, it's exciting.
Welcome to the club, Mr. Stay.
Yeah, what's it like?
Welcome to the club. Oh,
any tips?
Just any tips? Oh my gosh. Well, all I can say is that obviously it's always difficult when these big changes happen in life, but I think our podcast listeners should be cheering the fact that you're going to be more available to them, because, you know, I just think it's amazing. And you're right, you know, talking about having lived through that and living, as we are all living through this current publishing upheaval, I think it's going to be so incredible looking back again in future years as well, just having been part of the publishing industry for that long during the time when it all changed. I mean, yeah. It's going to be, you know, historically, we're going to be looking back at this. We're going to be looking back at it on a larger extent in terms of how the internet changed society and humanity and all the rest of it. But yeah, it's exciting times, but also, like you say, big, big shifts. So, well, personally, I want to wish you all the big best. And I know it's a very hard thing to go through, but also, like you say, I love the way you're responding to it, and so many opportunities await you, sir.
Yeah,
that's all I can say.
I'm looking forward to it. I really am. And, you know, I'll chronicle it here, honestly, you know, as we do on the podcast. We'll experiment. Well, I mean, I'm just looking forward to getting my teeth into so many different things, particularly with the podcast. It's we're going to have an amazing 2019. So hang in there, folks. It's going to be a bit of a ride, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Strap in your seatbelts for sure. Absolutely. So a bit of news on my end as well, Mr. Stay. I am absolutely shattered.
Okay.
Off the back of a 3-day exhibition that we did for the launch of a children's book, which I've mentioned a couple of times in the podcast.
How did it go?
It was incredible, actually. It was for the very last monster book, which is the book that my wife left me to publish before she passed away. And it was her goal. It was really interesting. She had two dreams around the writing. One was to just get the book out there. And that's what we did. That's what we did at the weekend. It was the most magical experience, because we spent, oh my gosh. I mean, it's 2 years since she started writing it. And then we had all the illustrations done, but the amount of work it's taken in the last 3 months to actually get this children's book launched. I tell people, we did this ebook, and it was like, you know, it's so much to learn. I said, but it was nothing on trying to publish a children's hardback book.
Yeah.
My goodness. Now, what was I thinking?
You've picked possibly the hardest genre to self-publish. You've done it fantastically. It's from what I've seen, I'm waiting for my copy to arrive. I can't wait to get my hands on it.
But
it looks just incredible. And this, again, I think is a future model where, if you want to get your voice heard, you know, if you want to get that beautiful book, you don't have to wait for a big publisher to do it. You know, if you want to take the opportunities, they're out there to be taken.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. We're nearly upwards of 2,000 copies sold.
Wow.
We're almost sold out of the limited edition, which is ridiculous. The other things and magical moments to share with you, that moment when the bookshop said, I'll take 10, please.
Yeah.
And then they stuck it up in the prime place in the bookshop, and then Instagrammed saying, this is going to be a classic. Like, that wasn't even prompted by me.
Oh my God.
So they really behind it.
That's brilliant.
And my best compliment, one of the best compliments we had at the exhibition was someone picked it up and they hadn't heard the story and we were, you know, there was a lot of people pre-order this. The best compliment I had was, God, this looks loads better than I thought it would.
A backhanded compliment there.
Well, it's brilliant, though, because it's, again, you know, you talk about this idea of self-publishing. People expect to see something, but we went full out. Like, it is the, it's high-end, high-spec. It's a work of art. It looks absolutely stunning. And then there's the other side of it. You know, the second dream that Jen had was about getting it out into the world, getting it as broadly distributed to as many children as possible. So I would give a big checkbox to dream one, which is I've got Jen's book now published, but now my mission is to see just how far I can take it. So I'm going to be documenting and chronicling that. One of the loveliest things, though, to experience having gone through it is to actually see the book in its physical sense. You know, talking about it is great, but actually to hold that book, and you don't get that with an ebook. Mm. And holding that book and watching all these kids come to the exhibition and picking up their copy. And a lot of them were taken back and put under Christmas trees all around the local community. And I thought, what a beautiful legacy for Jen's work and her life that she's now being spread out, almost like her ashes being scattered across the local community under all these Christmas trees. And I thought she would be absolutely thrilled to know that that's what actually happened to just this vision that she had. So it's been a very, it's been a really inspiring, a very difficult, like a heartbreaking, but also really inspiring couple of weeks. And I personally think despite the work it's taken to get it to this point, it's been such a brilliant way to actually grieve. You know, I say that really openly, like I am grieving, but I'm grieving by publishing my wife's book. And it's such a positive way to celebrate her life. And it's helping me hugely. I'm just like getting loads of hugs and getting to hear loads of people's stories about how the book's affected their life. One woman said to me, she sent me an email and she said that she's got extended medical stay in Victoria, which is down in the south of where I live, south of Ireland. And she said, I'm away from my family right now. She said, but this book has given me a target. She said, this book is my talisman. And I am determined to be out of hospital by Christmas so I can watch my kids open their presents under the tree.
Oh.
Isn't that amazing?
That is fantastic.
And suddenly you start to realize it's such a bigger thing than just the book.
Yeah.
Because it's connecting everyone's stories. And I could tell you another 100 stories like that. Honestly, it's been overwhelmingly beautiful. So I just want to publicly thank everyone, including all of our podcast listeners who've bought the book. I've seen your names pop up. We've still got a few left. Lastmonsters.com. Make me a very happy chappy and empty my garage, please. A few more boxes to go. But I just want to just say thank you to everyone. And also, I just want to let you know that I will be documenting this. I want to let you know how we did this. You know, it's gone into profit and I've been able to use some of the money to buy palliative care nurses gifts for Christmas because of what we've done here. So it's just incredibly inspiring. And this is the new, you know, you can, don't believe the hype when they say there's no money in children's books. You can run a business. And I now have a publishing company set up officially because I had to.
Get you.
So I'll document all that as well. I look at it. I tell you what, it's been the journey and a half, Mr. Stay. I haven't had much time to talk about it, but I will document further. So yeah.
No, we should. And just now, to go back to that local bookshop, do you have the name? Can we give them a shout out?
Fireside Books in Parksville.
Okay.
We'll stick there. We'll share their Instagram post, actually.
The
most loveliest people you've ever met. And, you know, that you talk about how indie bookstores and local bookstores really are the heart of community and support the community. Well, Fireside Books are one of those people. You go in there and you just feel the love and warmth and support and the excitement. And, you know, for me, long may they thrive and continue because they are an incredible part of our community, as everyone has in their own communities, I'm sure. So do support your local bookstores, folks.
Especially at this time of year, folks, it's so easy to order from Amazon, and I use Amazon a lot, you know, because I'm out in the middle of nowhere as well. But for books, mix it up. Go to a bookshop. I'm going tomorrow to Harbour Books in Whitstable. They've got an event on there with Julie Wasmer, former guest of the show, and they're having a big Christmas event there. And again, they put on events every single week that draws the community together. It's something, I mean, Amazon do what they do brilliantly. No one's ever going to beat them at that. But when it, like you say, the bookshop is almost replacing the pub as the heart of a town's community, isn't it?
And remember, bookshops will support you as a new author and a local author when you get your book out. So it's only right that we should be supporting them as well. So thank you to Fireside as well for giving us that that magical moment where I got to take a photo of my daughter standing next to her mummy's book on the shelf. It was just brilliant. You know, I just walked out of that bookshop and thought, that was that moment, you know, the moment you'll dream of. So
yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Brilliant stuff. Brilliant. So before we dive in, we've got a brilliant interview this week. We're going to give you a little teaser in a minute. Before we do, we're just going to talk a bit about covers. We have got a sponsor on the show called De Monza, who we absolutely love. We only ever take on sponsors who we love and we use. We should say that. So send us your gifts, send us your freebies. We'll try them out. And if we like you, you can come on the show with us.
Shameless, but,
shameless plug. But the thing that I'm drawn to about De Monza is I heard about De Monza through Shannon Mayer, who is a very, very successful indie publisher and author, obviously. He's been on the show a number of times. And we talk about the importance of the cover. Now, talking of covers, the cover that we had done for the last Monster book was done by the same designer that we did Back to Reality with. So we've stuck with, but he did the incredible lettering. And I think it's that cover that has made all the difference, because it's the thing that people pick up. It's the first thing that you see. And first impressions, unfortunately, do count in the book world. There's no way around it. So we talked to De Monza, and they've given us a special code for our listeners to try out their services. They are high end, but actually very reasonable cost with unlimited revisions, which is a thing that we've always talked about being absolutely essential if you're getting a book cover done. So pop along to demonza.com/bestsellerXP. And if you put in the code bestsellerXP, you will get a 10% off any of their packages, which includes ebooks, print versions of your books. They even do trailers for your books. Do check them out, because we know that Shannon's had incredible success with them.
Yeah.
And something that we might be looking into, Mr. Stay, I think, moving forward.
A little teaser. Yeah, we've been having conversations behind the scenes. So yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. Excellent stuff.
So Mark, tell us about our incredible guest today, Catherine Ryan Howard.
Well, Catherine's story is an amazing one. She's now, you know, this award-winning thriller author. Her book, Distress Signals, was published by Corvus and Blackstone in the USA. She's an Irish Times and USA Today bestseller. She's been shortlisted for the CWA John Creasy New Blood Dagger. Now, the CWA, remember, we had that's the Crime Writers Association. Michael Connolly, a few weeks ago, he mentioned he got the Diamond Dagger. Well, the New Blood Dagger is like for new writers. So just an amazing story, and it starts in the most unlikely place. She starts as someone who she says so herself, she was allergic to self-publishing, but she came around it in a very amusing and peculiar way. She talks on, she's got great tips on writing nonfiction, on writing proposals for nonfiction, which would be interesting to you, Mr. D. And she just has this amazing adventurous spirit. She's not afraid to step outside of her comfort zone, and I had a great time talking to her.
Excellent. So let's dive in with Mr. Stay and Catherine Ryan Howard.
Catherine, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm tickety-boo, absolutely tickety-boo. And I'm delighted to speak to you about your incredible career and your journey to publication, which from the bits and bobs I found about you on your blog and in interviews and what, it's just extraordinary. You started in self-publishing. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I always wanted to get published. Like, I can't remember not wanting to write books and get them on the shelf. But I always wanted to write a novel. And for years, like, I could have had a PhD in how to format a manuscript and how to find agents. And I had this whole library of books on the subject. A lot of them just said the same thing, but I bought new ones anyway. But a crucial mistake, never actually did any writing.
Right.
So I would write like two or three chapters of something, and I would always be emulating like the writers I like to read, but, you know, not bothered about silly things like plot or anything like that, and then get bored and give up. So I ended up going away and having some adventures abroad. And one of them was working as a front desk agent in Walt Disney World in Orlando.
Ooh.
And while I was there, you know, things didn't very much go to plan, because there was no plan. I just got on a plane and went. So I started writing the stories down. And then I thought, you know, actually, this might be a book. And I had never thought about writing nonfiction, but frankly, I was so desperate to get published at this stage that I was like, I'll write anything, you know, if I can get a book on a shelf. So I did write it, and I sent it into agents and editors, and all pretty much had the same response, which was that, you know, this isn't the worst thing we've ever read, but there's no market for it. So I came back to Ireland in 2008, which, if you know anything about the Irish economy, was the very worst
perfect
year
timing.
To come back
perfect
to Ireland.
Timing, yeah.
Just got in there right before the crash, and decided, okay, look, you know, a friend of mine sent me a link to a website called Lulu, which was a print-on-demand website. And I was looking at it, and like, I was always allergic to self-publishing. Like, I thought it was the last resort of the deluded loser. I just thought, you know, you were paying to publish a book that people had told you was not worth publishing. But I started thinking, look, I know where the market is for this book, which was by then called Mousetrapped. And I figured Disney fans, people going out to work in Florida, things like that, you know, even if I sold enough copies of it to keep me in the ink cartridges and coffee that I would need to finish the novel I had finally had an idea for, then I'd be happy with that. And that's what I did.
Fantastic. I just want to go back, because you bought pretty much every How to Write a Book going, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, every single one. Like, I used to go to Waterstones in Patrick Street in Cork, and they had like a shelf of them, and I would just go in every week and like get the next one along until I had read them all. Ask me anything, Mark. I mean, I'm a fountain of useless knowledge about how to get hold of it.
It's not useless, but I'm just interested, because I've been there too, and I've got lots of books on how to write. And they are books you are reading when you're not necessarily writing. But there is a little thing there where, certainly when you're starting out, you're buying into a dream, aren't you? But when you pick up these books, you read them and you think, you almost think, oh, there is a method. There is a secret way of doing this. There is, you know, if I save the cat, if I follow McKee's story, if I follow the hero's journey, I'll have untold riches in no time. But of course, it's you can wallow in that for so long, but sooner or later, you've got to, you know, put pen to paper, haven't you?
And that's the thing. And like, I love Save the Cat, and to this day, I use it for plotting. But what I was doing with these books was procrastinating. Like, I was focused on the dream and not at all interested in the, you know, the journey to get there, really. And if I could go back in time, the one thing I would do differently is I would put down those books and write a book myself, because I just think you could read those books for years and years, and some of them are brilliant and they're great for motivation and they're, you know, great for learning about the business and stuff, but I never learned as much as I did during those few months when I sat down and wrote Mousetrapped, or when I sat down and wrote my first novel. And I just wish I had gotten my arse in the chair sooner.
And that you mentioned Mousetrap there, because having been to Disney in Orlando myself, it is the happiest place on earth. If you're a tourist, if you're on the other side of the desk, it's obviously, you know, you're desperately trying to keep people happy, and you obviously had enough content there to write a novel. Write a travel book, sorry. What inspired that? What finally made you sit down and write those?
Despair, I think, generally. I mean, the thing is, like, I went to Florida. I'd never been to Florida before. I couldn't drive. I had no idea what was ahead of me. I had no place to live. And, you know, you're just full of sort of youthful exuberance when you're in your mid-20s. And I just thought, oh, sure, it'll be grand. Like, everything will work out. And to be fair, it did in the end. But at the beginning, it was just like one thing after another. And as you said, happiest place on earth. I certainly wasn't happy. And I just started writing, like, you know, emails home and long updates once I joined Facebook, which I did over there. And, you know, people thought what was happening to me was pretty funny. And like, when I look back, I thought, actually, this is at least mildly amusing. So I just started writing it all down, and it just started to take shape in my head as a book. And the great thing about nonfiction, which I learned from one of my libraries of how-to books, was that you don't have to write the book to submit it. You can write a proposal. Right. And that suited me down to the ground, because writing books was still something I wasn't doing. So I just put together a few chapters and sent it off. And I think, you know, I felt that if someone was coming out, because I had gone there on a specific training program, and I felt, you know, if there was one person coming out after me on the same thing, they'd be interested in this book. So, you know, why not? And it gave me something to do.
Yeah, well, that's it. How did you, how did you start compiling the book? Because we are interested in how nonfiction comes about as well as fiction. And obviously you're having a series of incidents while you're working out there. Were you keeping notes as you went along? Were you thinking, oh, this would be good for the book? How did you construct it?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the beginning I was keeping notes. And then because I started the book while I was out there, I was sort of having these experiences and thinking, this is a chapter, or, you know, if I go here, I can write about that. I think the first thing I did was I sat down and actually came up with titles for sort of chapters, but also kind of areas of my life out there. And there was a few things that presented themselves as sort of little capsule stories in themselves. Like one of my greatest dreams was to see a space shuttle launch. And I had no idea when I was a child that I would end up living like an hour's drive from Cape Canaveral. And as soon as I went there, I thought, oh, no problem. I'll be seeing shuttle launches every week. There'll be, you know, no problem at all. And of course, one thing, like, you know, I'd be working, or I'd get work off and then it would be cancelled, or the weather and so on and so forth. So I finally saw one in October the year I left, 2007. And that then just lent itself perfectly to a chapter of the book, because I could detail all the failures and mishaps and near misses, and then finally, you know, get to see this thing happen. So it was actually easier than I would have anticipated, probably because we're only talking about an 18-month period. So, you know, it kind of had its own logical narrative. It wasn't like I had to condense my whole life into, you know, book form. So
I'm immensely jealous. We went out to Cape Canaveral and we saw the Space Center, and it's fantastic, but I would love to see a shuttle.
I was an annual pass holder while I was out there, so what else?
Fantastic.
Yeah, one of the greatest things that happened besides the space shuttle launch is, very randomly, and this is the kind of stuff that started happening after I decided I was going to write a book, so I was delighted. I got to see an outdoor screening of Armageddon among the rockets in the Rocket Garden, because it was filmed on location. Right. And then afterwards, Bruce Willis came out and played a concert with his blues band.
Wow.
Say that. So, you know, things like that would never in a million years have happened to me at home. So for everything that went a bit arseways in Florida, like, I had a fantastic time in the end.
See, this is the thing I see in your story again and again, is you're very happy just to step out the door and have an adventure and put yourself at risk, you know, but you'll always come back with a story, won't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sort of way of glass half full after the fact. Because no matter what happens, you could write about it, you know? I mean, I often do think that to myself, like when things are going very wrong, I'm like, this is going to make a great chapter in the book I write about this eventually.
And you continued the adventure with Backpacked, which chronicled your journeys around South America.
Yeah, against my will.
Tell us about that. Yeah. How against your will?
Well, I was supposed to be coming back to Ireland, and my best friend, Sheila, who lives in New Zealand now, was in Ireland and said to me, I'm going backpacking in Central America. And in my head, I thought, sure, that's only down the road. Like, that's only a flight from, like, I'm in Florida, I'm practically there. It's certainly closer than Ireland. I'm not even sure that's true. So I arranged that she would come to Florida just as my visa was expiring. And then we would go to Central America for the bones of 3 months, basically. And then I'd fly home with her. And it was a terrible idea, because I am completely averse to almost everything backpacking involves.
Right.
I love fancy hotels. I hate moving. I hate doing things. I hate the risk of imminent death.
Well.
So it really, I was like the worst possible person to go backpacking, but I went because I knew, you know, good Facebook photos, and also I might write about it.
Excellent. And how did these two books do for you? How did they sell?
So I self-published Mousetrapped in March 2010. And I was very much right place, right time. Like I was blogging and I was tweeting, and self-publishing was just sort of shedding its, you know, deluded loser reputation. And I sort of stumbled into doing everything right. So I released that. And then I think a year later, I released Backpacked because I had an audience now and I wanted to give them something more. And then I followed that up with the obligatory How to Self-Publish a Book.
Yes.
And between the three of them, they sold around about 25,000 copies.
Wow.
But the vast majority were in ebook.
Right. Fantastic. And the self-publishing book is self-printed.
Yeah.
The Sane Person's Guide to Self-Publishing. So you put that out. I think it's in its third edition now. Is that right?
It was in its third edition, RIP, because the last edition was 2014 and
I
basically withdrew it then. Yeah. Because I stopped self-publishing and I just felt I just think there's way too many people out there already writing about how to do the thing they themselves have not done. So I just felt like, you know, let's put it to bed now. I'm not self-publishing anymore, so I don't feel right telling people how to do it. Because as you said, like things are changing daily. Like it's a completely different landscape now to what it was when I self-published even. So yeah.
Absolutely. So you were kind of an accidental non-fiction author, but what you always really wanted to do was write crime fiction and get published. So was there a point where you thought, how have I ended up doing this thing? I want to do this thing over here and I need to change course.
Yeah, I mean, I was constantly thinking that. Thinking that from the word go. But I knew how I had ended up there, which is that I hadn't written any fiction. I just didn't have any idea for a novel that sustained me past that kind of 10,000 word mark. And what actually happened is I first wrote, or tried to write, would be a better way to describe it, women's commercial fiction. Because although I loved crime, I felt like I wasn't able to write that. I wasn't old enough. I didn't have enough experience. I didn't have a contact in the FBI, which I was convinced, you know, you needed to write crime. And I thought I could get published with the women's commercial fiction. And of course, that is the most stupid thing you could possibly do. Like you should write the book that you want to read but can't find on the shelf. You should write in the genre that you love the most. And so that didn't work. And eventually, my mother has this habit. She sends links nowadays, but she used to actually bring home magazines and newspapers that she'd found left behind in cafes with stories she thought you were interested in. And like 9 times out of 10, you were not.
Yeah.
But on this one occasion, she gave me an edition of The Guardian's Weekend magazine from November 2011. And the cover story was John Ronson's Lost at Sea, which was about a Disney cruise cast member or employee who'd gone missing. And she bought it because of the Disney connection, which fine, like I read it. But what actually staggered me, what stopped me in my tracks in the middle of the article was this phrase, the International Cruise Victims Organization. And I'd never been on a cruise. I knew absolutely nothing about it. But when I thought of cruises, I thought of pina coladas and sunsets and relaxation and terrible cabarets. And also norovirus, but whatever. I didn't think about victims of anything. And I couldn't understand what could be going on or how it could be going on such a scale that this organization had to exist. So I started Googling and looking into it and was basically horrified by what I found out about maritime law. And the wannabe crime writer inside of me started thinking, look, if I was a serial killer and I wanted to kill someone, I would do it on a cruise ship because you're almost guaranteed to get away with it. And that's where the idea for this novel that became Distress Signals began to form. And I'd love to tell you that I sat down and the whole thing flowed out and it was done in 3 months, but like cut to 2 years later and I still hadn't finished it.
Right.
And I was actually getting really down because it turns out that like checking your Gmail constantly for an agent saying, I want to publish you isn't, you know, the best of fun.
No.
So I applied to go back to college and I got a place. I went back as a mature student. I'm 32 by now. We've skipped ahead a bit.
Okay.
So I knew then that the time I had was going to be greatly diminished and I needed to finish the book. And I finished my first draft about a week before college began. And then I started.
A deadline. A deadline. See, we're always going about ideas.
I mean, I have to have deadlines and I ignore them. My real deadlines are about like 5 weeks after the actual deadline. I get there in the end.
Okay. You're absolutely right about cruise. When I was a teenager, we used to go on terrible holidays, camping holidays, you know, pontins and stuff like that. As soon as I leave home, my parents start going on cruises, you know, coincidence. And the stories you hear about, like you say, norovirus, but, you know, on every cruise, there's always someone who either breaks something or snuffs it, you know, or I mean, it just in the news a few weeks ago, there was this woman who fell off the cruise ship.
I read that. Yeah. She was in the water for like 10 hours or something.
Yeah.
I met people once who were actually in Dublin. I met them on the train here off a cruise for the day. And they said, what's funny, although I don't think this is funny, is that when they pull into every port, they see an ambulance waiting to take a body off, because the average age on cruises is, you know, the upper end of the scale, let's say. So people are constantly dying on them, even just from natural causes.
So you have this deadline, you get your book finished, you're also studying. So where do you go from there?
So I submitted to various agents and I got like a few thanks but no thanks rejections. And that was fine because college just was so time consuming. And I thought, look, okay, I can focus on this. And 6 weeks into my 4-year degree, I got an email from Jane Gregory, who is my dream agent and who I was terrified of submitting to because you're only allowed to send her 10 pages and everyone else took 50. And I thought, how can you even tell in 10 pages? Like, this is a waste of time. But I got an email saying, we want to represent you.
Wow.
And then 6 months into my 4-year degree, because we worked together on another draft, I got a book deal. I had a very, very exciting Monday afternoon when 5 days after it went out on submission, Distress Signals was preempted as part of a 2-book deal by Corvus Books.
Wow.
So it was crazy. And then I was like, okay, what am I supposed to do now? Because I still have to finish the degree. But it all worked out. It was very stressful.
Yeah, that must that's be careful what you wish for, isn't it? Because if you're doing a degree and then suddenly you've got a 2-book deal with a major publisher like Corvus and you've got to deliver, how did you manage your time?
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, I didn't. And I didn't deliver.
Good for you.
That's the simple answer. Basically, what happened is Distress Signals was written, thankfully, and you know, you're thinking about that first book for so many years, and you know, you don't really think beyond that. Like, no one ever starts thinking about, hey, book two, but I didn't worry about it. So Distress Signals was coming out, and there was a really long lag time. Like, I signed my deal in March 2015, the book came out in May 2016. And all that time, I should have been working on book two, but I was just about hanging in there in college and also just really looking forward to my biggest dream coming true. And every time I like sat down to work on book two, I would get distracted by something that was happening with book one. Like, here were the proofs, or we found out this person is going to review it or whatever. So I didn't do anything, basically. And then I ended up with severe second book syndrome.
Right.
And it was really bad. And I thought, I can never write anything again. I'm just reduced to typing now. I don't know like how I even... It was really quite difficult because I was sitting where I am now in front of my computer looking at a blank page. And then I remember, like, we got this review from the Irish Times, and there was a phrase in the review that I'll never forget for as long as I live. It said, impeccably sustained with not a false note. And that was for Distress Signals. And I'm sitting there and I can't write a paragraph.
Oh my God.
And I'm thinking, how can I be impeccably sustained when I can't even cobble together 500 words that make sense? So it was just very, very difficult. And the moral of the story is I basically ended up finishing book two a year after I should have. But everyone forgave me because they were like, it's your second book, you know, this is what happens. And it turned out really well in the end, surprisingly well. So,
well, here's the thing as well. I mean, you were an Irish Times and a USA Today bestseller as well. You were shortlisted mm-hmm. for the CWA and New Blood Dagger, you know, so it did pretty well. We were talking to Miranda Dickinson about this. Her first book did extraordinarily well. For a second book, she was told, oh, if it sells less than 60,000, we'll be disappointed. That must be incredible pressure, you know, to suddenly think, ooh, you know, it almost dreams have come true, but now I've got to work so hard.
I mean, no one tells me anything about sales, so
right.
I'm fine with not knowing how many they want me to sell. I mean, my whole thing was this, like, I was a bit of a control freak, let's say, when the first book came out, because I had come from self-publishing and I had also been doing some freelance work for Penguin Ireland here, like social media stuff for them. So I kind of knew a bit too much.
Right.
And I really wish that I had just relaxed a bit more and let the people who know how to publish books publish my book and maybe spend some time working on the second one instead. But now I'm just much more relaxed and I just feel that the only thing I can do is write the best book I can, and after that, you know, everything else is completely beyond my control. And I've signed another deal for two more books.
Brilliant.
So it's not gone completely catastrophe yet.
And
that's all I want. I just want to be able to write books and have people publish them, and whatever level of success sustains that is fine with me.
But you're right. Self-publishing does spoil you, doesn't it? I mean, it's a lot of work, but when you have complete control over the cover, the pub date, the pricing, and you can see the sales in real time. Because I'm going through that. I've got this fantasy novel coming from Unbound next year, and I'm sort of sitting there drumming my fingers thinking, I wonder what they're doing on social media. I wonder what the cover's going to be like. I wonder what the pub date's going to be. I wonder what their ebook pricing is like. And you do. I mean, you have to ask the questions, but you also need to calm down a bit and get on with your side of the job, which is the writing bit.
Yeah, I mean, I wish someone had just like given me a Xanax and locked me in a room, because I was a terror. Like, I was an absolute terror. The thing with self-publishing is that you only have, and this is true as well in traditional publishing, you, the author, only have one book. That's all you're thinking about. You're just focusing on this one book, and you're sitting there thinking, why has no one emailed me about this? Or why is that word wrong on my Amazon listing? Or why? And you're talking to people who are juggling dozens upon dozens of books, and they know we'll all get there in the end and everything will be fine. But I'm getting very good at it now. I don't know what happened to me over the last few months. I think it was the trauma of the second book syndrome, but I just am very zen about the whole thing now. And I just want to, you know, I'm just going to be that really jerk person who's like, oh, it's all about the work. Like, I mean, as I said, as long as things are ticking along at a level that means I can keep doing this, then that's great for me.
The wonderful thing about you as well, Catherine, is you've started giving stuff back as well. You give regular talks and advice on writing. Your blog is fantastic. You're also a founding member of the Inspiration Project, which is billed as a writing retreat with a difference. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so two of my very good writing buddies and unpaid therapists, Carmel Harrington and Hazel Gaynor, both hugely successful writers in their own right. We came together to found this thing that we call the Inspiration Project. And it started off as a residential writing retreat that took place over a weekend. And you spent one day, you know, with us doing seminars and stuff. And we did a bit of one-on-one mentoring, and then you had some time to write. But the real motivation behind it is that I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but certainly in Ireland, there is this attitude of the poverty-stricken writer.
Yes.
And if you, which is a reality as well, I mean, it's not just an attitude, but my issue with it is that if you see a talk billed as how to make a living as a writer or whatever, you go along to it and the first thing they tell you is that that's not possible. And that's just not true. Like, it's not likely, but it's not impossible that you will make a living as a writer. I do, Hazel does, Carmel does, because we write commercial fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time when people are talking about the poverty-stricken writer, they're talking about literary fiction, or they're lumping literary fiction in and getting an average from that. And I just think, like, we don't want to be Pollyanna about this, and we don't want to lead people, is it down the garden path or up the garden path, but along the garden path, we don't want to do that. But I just don't think it's helpful to say to people at the very beginning of their journey, you will never make any money out of this. You will never get paid to do what you love, you know, or take money out of the equation altogether, because I think writers are really reticent to talk about money or say they want money, but money equals readers equals money. Like, if you have readers, you're going to be getting paid royalties. And do I want readers? Absolutely. Otherwise, I'd keep a diary. Like, what is this all for if I don't want people to read my book? So we just wanted to inject some realism, but also some positivity into the whole thing.
So what kind of authors are you looking for the and listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes for this so you can check out the Inspiration Project. Are you looking for people who are just starting out, or people who maybe have finished a draft and looking to take it to the next level? What kind of authors come to the Inspiration Project?
Well, the authors we get are actually people at all stages of their career. We have some absolute beginners. We have some people who finished a draft. We have some people who may have published a book in the past and are now working on a different genre, or maybe we have a lot of very small independent publishers here in Ireland, and people get their books published with them and things don't work out like they imagined they would in their dreams. So they're looking for a bigger publisher or things like that. I mean, we really have designed it so that there is something to benefit everyone in there. I personally think you would get the most out of it if you were at least coming to us with an idea, maybe even an outline, and you're prepared to get to work hard on it.
Have you been on many retreats yourself?
No. So I love a good workshop. I love a good seminar, but I don't like retreats. I don't like the sort of dinner bell goes at 6 o'clock and I have to go downstairs, because that might be when I'm, you know, it might take me that long just to get going.
Yeah.
I live by myself, so I don't really have to go on retreats because I've all the peace and quiet I want here. But I do like to go away. I do kind of go to nice sunny places every now and then under the guise of writing. I'm not sure how much word count actually gets done. But what I love about workshops and things like that is half the time it's not even the content. It's just the fact that for a day or a weekend, you have spent your time with other people who say, I want to be a writer too. And you're all talking about that and you're motivating each other, and it's kind of like, you know, I know it sounds a bit silly to say, but it's like a safe space for your dreams. Because when you're at home and you say, I want to be a writer, you know, people are like, mm-hmm, and I want to be, you know, Tom Cruise, but it just takes like a little seed of doubt at the beginning. It only takes one little remark for you to think, actually, you know, I can't do this, this is ridiculous, this is a silly dream to have. Whereas when you're around other writers, I just think there's a bit of a protection, a bit of, you know, a bit of space for you to dream. And I think everyone should dream. Like, why are we here otherwise if not to try and have the lives we want? So that's getting very now self-helpy. So I'll just pull back.
No, it sounds great, because I've a very this kind of working class suspicion of retreats. It's like, what, you have to go to a cottage in Devon to write a book? I can do it on the bus, you know.
Can you do it on the bus? Well, I definitely can't do it on the bus.
I write on the train, so I
okay.
So it can be done. It can be done. You know, we've had we had the gingerbread competition earlier in the year, and one of the people who was shortlisted, I'm pretty sure she was doing it on her phone on the bus. She was writing her novel.
Oh my God.
You know, that's how she did it. So
that makes me feel terrible, because I need like absolute silence.
So, you know, it can be done. But yeah, I'm going on one, and it's in Switzerland as well. So it's proper swanky stuff. But
And have you been to the area before? Because I think that's the downfall, is when you go. Because one year I went to Nice, in the south of France to write, apparently. But I've never been there before, and I just spent all my time wandering around.
Yeah.
yeah. cafeing and stuff. So yeah. Godspeed.
Well, I think we're halfway up a mountain in the middle of the Swiss Alps. So any wandering, I'll probably go over the edge of a cliff or a waterfall or something.
That
so
sounds like a great place to have a retreat for that very reason.
It should be good. It should be good. And do stay listening, listeners, because I'll be reporting back from that. Now, The Liar's Girl came out this March. And you know, your difficult second book. I also saw, just to make life a little more difficult for you, you had to launch the thing in the snowiest winter since time began. So tell us about that launch, because you were going from bookshop to bookshop, you know, trudging through the snow. A summer book next time, maybe?
Please, because it was the absolute worst. No, it was during the Beast from the East.
Yeah.
And Ireland, I'm here in Dublin, had never seen it. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I actually couldn't leave the house on the day the book came out. It was just awful. The stock didn't get to the shops. Oh. And then, I mean, it did eventually, but like not, you know, on the day, and various things were cancelled. And, you know, it just got to the point where I was like, I let this go. Like it's happened. And the thing is, it's a bit weird for me because I have the trade paperback that comes out really for Ireland.
Yeah.
And then when the mass market comes out, which is due in January, that's really the UK launch.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of, you know, because I'm all zen now. So I'm just like, let it go, looking ahead and on to the next thing. So yes, it really was the worst possible week to release a book in Ireland. But you look, there's always something. Yes. Always something.
Yeah. Now, you've, before we start recording, you were telling me today, literally today, you've just finished the first draft of a new book.
Yes.
So
that very, very painful process.
how is it? Are you happy with it?
I was happy with it until today.
Right.
Like when I went to bed last night, I thought this actually is not bad. And you know, maybe they won't fire me and et cetera, et cetera. But now, of course, as soon as you send it off, you think, oh, wait, I should have done that. But I'm actually really excited about this idea. I can't say too much about it, but the structure of the book is quite unusual. And I'm just hoping that it works. And I'm sure I'll find out in a few days from my agent and editor if it does. And hopefully it does, because I can't face writing another first draft.
Well, the thing with first drafts is very often they're as rough as a wombat's bum. Bingo!
Well, we had to get that ding, in. Ding,
yes.
Ding.
Now, listeners, I had a thing with Miranda Dickinson that I had to get the phrase "as rough as a wombat's bum" into the podcast today. So I think she owes me money or something. I'm not sure how that works, but yes. Catherine, thank you so much for speaking to me today. We'll put links in the show notes to the Inspiration Project, because I think that sounds fantastic. And we wish you all the best with all your projects in the future.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of the Bestseller Experiment.
Oh, bless you.
Delight for me.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
She has the most loveliest accent I think I've heard from many of our guests.
Yeah, well,
I've got a soft spot for the Irish.
It's cool. Well, my family are from Limerick, and some of them are from Cork, and Catherine's from Cork. So yeah, I won't do my Irish accent. I won't. But I know. Oh. I've done many accents on this show, but it would be an insult to Catherine for me to do that on this one. I'll do it on another episode when she's not listening.
Excellent. Yeah. Absolutely.
What a great
interview though. She's so much spirit. I love it. I love the stories that she told us, and so much to talk about. I mean, I've got to say, we do have a new acronym. You know, we like to create t-shirts, actually. I've got a new acronym that I wrote down, which is just simply AITC. I think every author should have that t-shirt printed. Can you remember what it might mean, Mr. Stay?
AI.
In the chair. I think we should either have that as t-shirts or a big sign up on our wall when we're walking past our writing desk. Get your AITC.
Yeah, get your ass in the chair. I like that. Like that. Beautiful. Very much. Yeah. But that said, you know, she's someone who, you know, Byron likes to go on an adventure. You know, she goes off to Florida, jumps at the deep end, working at Disney, you know, all this kind of stuff. And you're putting yourself in situations where, like she said, she was saying, and this is something that Bryan Cranston said. He said, you know, if you're having a difficult time, just tell yourself it will make for a good story later on.
Yes, exactly. I remember that when she said that, I was thinking of Bryan, because it's so true. you know, mild consolation when you're actually going through the trauma, but absolutely something that you should be drawing on because, you know, life, the best bits in life happen at the extremes, ultimately. I mean, it's if you have a life that's, in fact, here's a really cool analogy. Somebody once told me, you think about life being a roller coaster and, you know, up and down. If life was not a roller coaster, it would be a flat line, literally flatlining, which means you're pretty much dead. So, you know, you've got to have the good with the bad. And if you can take stories out of the bad, then you can always make use of it for sure. The other thing that really I loved that Catherine said, this really spoke to me. She talked about this idea of the poverty-stricken writer, this kind of almost syndrome that we all badge ourselves with, oh, I'm, you know, I'm going to be a poverty-stricken. And the fact that she loves to dispel that idea right from the outset. And it was such a brilliant point because it's so true, isn't it? We shouldn't be going into this thinking, oh, well, we're definitely, you know, life of destitution ahead of us if I'm going to become a writer.
Yeah, and what it does is perpetuates this idea that you shouldn't even pay writers. You know, I mean, this is something I see a lot in screenwriting where, I mean, I turned down a gig recently because, you know, I had a Skype call with the producer of this film and they asked me to come up with some ideas for a rewrite. They'd had a screenplay. They weren't happy with it. They needed a rewrite. So I spent a good few days putting together some rewrite ideas. We had the Skype conversation and they liked my ideas very, very much. And they said, great, well, we'd like you to, you know, put that together as a sort of synopsis. And I said, okay, I'll give you my agent's details and we'll talk about fees. Oh, no, we haven't got any money. And it's like, well, I'm not going to do it. Yeah, I'm not going to do it. I'm not working for exposure. I'm not working, you know, to get someone's good books. If they're getting paid, I can guarantee the caterers will be getting paid on the set. The set decorators will be getting paid. The actors will, the actors get an even worse deal than the writers most of the time. But, you know, the producers will be paid and the writers should be bloody paid as well. And I think Catherine's right. This perpetuates this idea that, oh, we got to, you know, live in a garret and not go out and survive on toast and cold tea. But no, if you can, and maybe if you're all...
Dream of eating hobnobs, right? Yeah, of eating hobnobs.
Exactly. You know, aspire to hobnobberdom. But, you know, if you're...
Hobnobberdom. That's definitely got to be there for entry into the dictionary in a few years. That's brilliant. No, yeah, but good for you, Mark, because, you know, I want to say this, you know, ultimately, you know, if you do stuff for free in this world, how much value are you attaching to what you do if it's always free? I mean, I'm absolutely all about giving of time and being, you know, giving of service and being of service to others. But when it's your career, when it's something that you actually are earning money from, you have to set a boundary and you have to say, I don't work for free. I guess, it pays well to ask that question up front, because I guess sometimes people just expect that writers are just going to grab any gig they can because it's like they're all just looking for the credit and it's nothing to do with the income, but people have to live and eat hobnobs. So good for you. So there's a warning to anyone. Don't you ever come asking Mr. Stay for anything unless it's got at least, what, six figures attached to it?
I won't get out of bed for anything less.
The other thing that I loved as well is she's talked about how, and we've seen this time and time again, and I really want to focus on this quickly because it's really inspiring. And I think it's very universal. I think everyone goes through this. And that's this idea that even if you've had success in something, especially if it's writing, it's still human to believe that you can't follow it up or you might fail or you can't write. She talked about not being able to write. And I thought, how brilliant is that, that even someone who's done really well has that fear?
Yeah, I mean, it's that, you know, she's talking about the stress of good reviews. She'd been an Irish Times, USA Today bestseller. She'd won awards. People were saying this is the most amazing book. And that can lead to a kind of paralysis, you know, that kind of, you kind of freeze. And how do I live up to that? And I think, you know, part of it is maybe, you know, don't believe your own publicity, you know, that kind of thing. But also you have to put the past aside, you know, you have to write in that moment. And I mean, we won't put it on the show, but when we were doing the sound check for this, because I spoke to Catherine over Zencaster when we recorded it, I said, could you say a few words just so I can get a sound, a level for the sound, please, Catherine? She said, yep, I hate first drafts. which I loved. And of course, we've that's got our ongoing debate about first drafts and what have you. But, you know, that's the thing. I have this, you know, whenever I do a first draft of something and you read it back and you see mistakes and there's a part of me that goes, I'm so disappointed in you. You should know this by now. But there's another part of me that, having been through the process so many times, you realize it's a process.
Yes, it's a process.
That's my process anyway, which is I'll get something down. It'll be imperfect. I will rework it and rewrite it until it gets better and better and better.
And I would go as far as to say, Mr. Stay, that it's worth just writing a book, even if it's never going to go out into the world, to learn that process. Because once you know that process, then you can kind of intellectualize with yourself that, okay, it's all right. I'm just going through that. You know, what was the word count? It was like the 25,000 words where you hit the wall and you think, hey, I'm rubbish. I'm never going to. And it's funny, you know, we talk about in music, we talk about that difficult second album. I don't know if is that a kind of saying in the publishing world, the difficult second book?
Totally. Yeah, totally. Okay. It's because so many authors, and I interviewed someone just this week, it's going to be in a future episode. She spent 13 years on her first book. 13 years.
Wow.
And then had to deliver.
And that's not uncommon.
No, it's not. I mean, we spoke to Liz Fenwick, and one of her books, she did over 40 drafts of it, you know. So, so much of that first book is about discovering who you are as a writer, particularly if it's one that does eventually get published. I mean, obviously, we've got lots of unpublished books that, you know, that we end up getting trunked, as they say.
I've not heard that before. Trunked. Yeah. What do you mean by that? Like,
it's weird. I've heard it about 3 times in the last 2 weeks. It's so weird. It's just like, you know, when you say number 27, you start seeing the number 27 everywhere. The idea that you finish it and maybe send it to agents, you get rejections, you go, okay, I'm putting that in the trunk. I'm going to start something new. And I've got plenty of those, you know, books that just aren't good enough, but I learned something from them and I've moved on.
Yeah, and they are an essential part of your journey as a writer, ultimately. I don't think any book, no book is ultimately pointless or worthless, because we talk about in life, and I coach about this all the time, life is about stepping stones. It's always about it's not necessarily the person you meet that might be the person that changes your life, but it might be a person they know that they introduce you to. And that person is a stepping stone. Often your book could be that stepping stone to the big opportunity or the big thing that changes your life. And we have to remember that everything happens for a reason, I think. You know, each book you're writing is happening for some purpose in the bigger picture. So
yeah. And no writing is wasted. You know, even if you're having a terrible day, even if it's a terrible bit of writing, you will have got you've got something down that you can work with, and B, you will learn something from it. You know, I put a thing on Instagram the other day about a chapter that I'd written in the thing that I'm working on at the moment. And I'd read it back my train was just coming in to stop. And I just left myself a note saying, what is the point of this scene? You know, so I felt like I'd had a really bad writing morning. And when I read the scene, it was just people walking in, introducing themselves, and then walking out again. It's like, where's the drama in that? You know, but there were a couple of things in that I said, actually, you know what? If we get rid of him, and if she's there all the time, and then suddenly it's revealed, and that was it. You know, from a bad morning, I then had a really exciting chapter. You know, it's just
excellent. I remember once writing, spending a whole day on a writing retreat and looking back at what I'd written when I was writing this middle grade novel, and basically could sum up my entire days of writing of people chasing each other down a tunnel. That was it. And I thought, this is just not going to happen. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. But yeah, it's, you know, but again, it leads somewhere ultimately. And I'm glad you pulled something out of that. Yeah. The other thing that I loved that Catherine said that was really a really nice way of looking at it, and actually leads to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago, about this idea that we write. The reason we are authors is we are writing for an audience. We want to share our work. We want our work to be out there. And she put it so beautifully. And she said, if I want readers, otherwise I'd write a diary.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
I loved it. And isn't it true? Isn't it a great way of putting it? Because Although with a diary, you're always kind of slightly concerned if anyone ever actually picks it up. It's like the worst thing. You don't want a reader. But isn't that a great way of kind of defining the difference between what it is of being an author and what it is that someone who enjoys writing, but just doing it for their own journaling purposes and just to document and, you know, work through their own experiences in life.
Yeah.
Just a great way.
I think it's a lovely way of putting it. And Mark Billingham made a good point last week because he came from stand-up comedy and he says he always thinks of his audience because he comes from that comedy background. And he said, you can't walk on stage and say, right, just give me 15 minutes and then I'll be funny. You know, let me warm up to the funny bits. He's like, no, you go on, you know, if you go on stage, you've got to grab them straight away. And the same with your writing, you know, you are writing for, I mean, you know, write for yourself, by all means, write something that you're passionate about. But just remember, particularly if you want to make money out of this thing, that you've got to engage readers and keep them,
to grab them.
Keep
them actually, on the hook. It's a brilliant analogy, isn't it? This idea of, you know, standing up on stage as a comic and having to start and make people laugh from the outset. And it's a similar kind of analogy when you think about somebody opening page one of your book. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a comedy, but it has to grab them. And we know that because people haven't got the patience to sit around waiting for you to warm up. So as we discovered, didn't we? We ended up ditching quite a lot of the stuff early on in Back to Reality.
Yeah,
because we just wasn't keeping the pace going. No. There was some great stuff in there, but ultimately it was just not moving the plot forward fast enough.
Yeah.
And that was a really fascinating thing to have gone through because you do realize you have to be pretty brutal with yourself.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
Remember that you're there to entertain and to thrill or to make people laugh. Or help people fall in love, whatever your genre is, and you've got to deliver that. You can't really beat around the bush.
Don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Nice, absolutely. Fantastic stuff. So there's been a lot happening on social media because NaNoWriMo has come to an end. Another year.
Yeah, it's been absolutely...
So what's been happening out there?
Well, I
Twitterverse?
I went to the BXP group on our special Facebook page for our Patreon supporters, and I just said... NaNoWriMo, how do we do? What have we learned? And some amazing responses. Julian Barr says, for me, the best part has been the joy of seeing my friends succeed. Bethany Swofford said, I managed to write 41,000 words despite everything this month. She woke up with the flu this morning, so yay for that. And she agrees that, you know, with Julian that seeing everyone else reach their goals has been inspiring. Not sure I learned anything except cold medicine and stairs do not go together. So get well soon, Bethany. Penny Johnson said, managed nearly 24K. Procrastination ruled, sadly. Must try harder next month. But, you know, Penny there has 24,000 words that she didn't have last month. She's got something to work
with. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love it that people are disappointed they only knocked out 24,000.
Yeah. A mere 24,000 words.
A good month
words.
For most people.
Logan Bolam, he said, I ignored it completely. Good for you, Logan. Craig Addison said, I've learned not to go into day 29 with 7,000 words to write. I've also learned I can function on 4 hours sleep.
Amazing.
Rosemary Dew said, I reached my target. Yes, go Rosemary. Could probably have pushed myself a bit harder, but happy with how my story is progressing. So that's all cool. Let's have a look. Richard Bat-Bruce, he said, 20,000 for me. A bit disappointing, but not bad considering mine and my dad's health. So hope you get well soon and your pa. I hope that works out for you. Now, KW Sage, Sage and Ink on Twitter as well. It looked for a long time that she wasn't going to make it. Look at her blog and her tweets because she was blogging about this, but she said, I'm a winner, baby. I didn't think I would because I was 17,000 words down on the 28th, but I did it. 17,000 words.
The last 2 days.
Amazing, amazing work. Anne Woodward, she said, I found it very motivating. Reached 50,000 words early, much to my delight and surprise. Appreciated the wonderful support from fellow writers and overwhelmed by other successes. Lots of determined writers out there, all battling their own demons or passing obstacles. In a world where so much is negative, NaNo has made a big difference to this writer's heart, which is lovely. Now, Robin Sarti. Robin is just a legend. She says here, I managed my personal goal of 100,000 words, right, in a month.
Wow.
She said, the public declaration to this definitely helped me to reach my goal, and a very patient husband. Now, of course, you remember Robin was typing one and handwriting with the other. and she did a 10K sprint the other day, 10K in one day, which is just amazing. And then Jack Harmon reached 50,000 after frantic last-minute dash for the Lion. Can't wait to read it in 6 months and marvel at how much drivel I can manage in 30 days.
That's amazing. I've got to tell you something about Jack quickly, very off, really funny. Jack, I want to thank Jack because she ordered the very last Monster book and I actually saw on the order form her address, obviously, because we had to send it to her. She actually still lives where I lived for 15 years in a tiny little village in the middle of Cambridgeshire with 4,000 people, and she walks past the house we have every single day.
No way! What?
I mean, we don't even know each other apart from through the podcast. I've never met Jack, but now we're chatting kind of privately. I said, it's just bizarre. Isn't that mental? The same village of 4,000 people in Cambridgeshire.
That's so weird.
She walks past our house every day.
That's so weird.
Hello, Jack.
And last but not least, another Jack. Jack Logan, author. This is on Twitter, at Jogler. And he said, NaNoWriMo, and on the 29th day, he looked down at the word count and saw that it was done. So I follow Jack daily. His daily tweets on his word count. Some days were better than others, but he made it. So congratulations. Big, big congratulations,
I think,
to Jack.
Massive congratulations to absolutely everyone. And as we say, NaNoWriMo doesn't just have to be for November. And that is really the idea behind our public declaration, the BXP, or the Bestseller Experiment Public Declaration. If there's something that you want to do once a month, then let the world know through our podcast, come to Twitter, come to Facebook, tell the word, declare. Because ultimately, as you can see from all these incredible stories of people just doing things that seem almost like supernatural, superhuman, like to bash out 100,000 words in a month or 17,000 words in the last 2 days. But it is possible when you set a target. And I often think, what would happen if we could start doing that? Not necessarily every week. But what if we could do that to, say, even half our year?
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine what would happen to the how prolific we'd become as writers?
Yeah.
It'd be amazing. We'd all be like Shannon Mayer.
Exactly. I was just going to say, we'd almost be as prolific, almost as prolific as Shannon.
Yeah. Exactly. Because that's an average day for her, 10,000 words.
Thanks to everyone who responded on our Facebook group for our Patreon supporters. If you want to get involved in that, pop over to Patreon.
I can jump in there, Mark. Okay. If you like, patreon.com/bestseller experiment.
Fantastic.
And for those new listeners that may be joining us today, the Patreon is basically a way to help support the podcast. We have three different tiers, of which the top tier is a measly $10 a month, which gives you access to all kinds of incredible, incredible extras. So if you're really serious about making this work from a writing perspective, then people have told us this is not us promoting it. They've told us this is like conference level material as a Patreon supporter. So please, please come and join and support us in Hobnobs for the next year.
And thanks to our new Patreon supporters this week, Sam Makuza, thank you, Tony Price, and Sean Locke. We did wonder if that was the comedian Sean Locke. I'm not sure it is, though. Hello, Sean.
Thank you so much, Sean, and welcome to everyone.
And some more stuff on Twitter. We had a tweet from Abigail Mann. She's sent us a public declaration update. She reached 50,000 words of her manuscript by the end of November and started December pitching to an agent for the first time. A bit of a hard sell, as I wrote contemporary women's fiction and they were psychological thriller specialists, but it was great. Well, look, you're just starting out. You know, this is fantastic, Abigail. So congratulations on beating your declaration and good luck with the submissions. Keep us informed on how that's going. Now, you remember you were talking last week, Mark, about habit forming small steps. Steve Gowland got in touch. He said, I totally agree about the habit forming small steps. So my goal will be 200 words per day, every day. And that,
brilliant.
You'll have a novel in a year, Steve. Absolutely guarantee it.
Absolutely.
No question whatsoever.
And it will get bigger and bigger and bigger as well. That's the thing. You start small and you get hooked. Absolutely hooked, and it will start increasing.
Now, if you do NaNoWriMo and you're writing so much in a month, then it might drive you a little bit crazy. How about someone like Sam J. Wright on Twitter? For the month of November, I went through all 153 episodes of the Bestseller Experiment.
Were they writing from the psychiatric ward of their local hospital?
to encourage me to get through NaNoWriMo. Just finished episode 153 and so happy to find this community. It's really encouraging and I want to thank the Marks for sharing all the hard work. Sam, thank you, but please have a lie down. You know, doing NaNoWriMo is hard enough, but then binging 150, that's about 150 something hours at least.
Hours?
Of art.
I mean, how many work? That's actually like a four, that's 4 weeks of working, like a 40-hour week, right? That's like four, in the month of November.
Maybe Sam's plugged into the Matrix. You know when he puts that thing in the back of his head, he says, I know Kung Fu. Maybe we should get that as a kind of app where you plug the bestseller experiment into the back of your head and you go, I know about publishing.
Just download it. Well, the other thing, I start to wonder whether we're going to have to put like a warning on the front page of the website, like cigarette packets. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, seriously,
it's
damage
getting
your
quite
health.
Dangerous. Yeah. That is brilliant. 153. Well, you, Sam, you officially hold the record because we've only done just a few more episodes than that. So you are now the official binge listener of the bestseller experiment. If anyone can beat that, if they're listening to this, like, you know, in 50 episodes time, if you're binge listening in less than a month, let us know, because maybe you can take the Guinness World Record of craziest listeners. But Sam, we're very welcome to have you, and we hope that you can put us with up for a few weeks longer, I think.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, hang in there.
153, that's amazing.
It's incredible.
God, so you can imagine the people that live with us, they couldn't put up with that. 153 hours of us waffling on.
Yeah, God, my kids can barely put up with me for 20 minutes now, yeah.
Exactly. It's like after 2 minutes, like, oh, Dad
shut leave, up.
Give it a rest. I'm trying to watch the show. Anyway, that's brilliant stuff. Excellent stuff. So we've got some really great things coming up over the next few weeks. Especially, we should make a kind of a little preview. We've mentioned it before, but for our new listeners, we have a very special Christmas special episode coming up. Don't we, Mark? Do you want to tell our listeners about that?
Oh, yeah, this is going to be fun. I spoke to the legend that is Ian Rankin, and he talks us through his incredible career. And I end up doing my Sean Connery impression to a Scotsman. It's an interesting, I got out alive,
that's
clearly
worth, that's but, worth yeah. tuning in just for that.
I mean, you want to talk about an inspirational author. Ian is that exactly. He takes us through the ups and downs and everything that he's seen along the way, and he was in such good form. It's such a good episode, so yeah, that's going to be a cracker.
Yeah, so look forward to that. And obviously we'll have lots of incredible things happening over the next year. We're going to be talking about the competition winner now, because back at the beginning of November, to celebrate the beginning of our discounts with demonza.com, they also gave us the opportunity to give away one of their packages. Now, this is a package that is worth over $500. What's that in pounds, Mark? About 350 quid, something like that?
Well, but, I mean, absolutely. We've got Brexit going on.
Well,
it
depends. Day to day, right? Yeah, it's probably worth about 2 pence. No. We're probably actually worth about 1,000 quid. But we're going to announce now the winner of our De Monza cover competition. So thank you to everyone who entered. And remember as well, everyone who was a patron supporter gets automatic entry into all the competitions. So, Mr. Stay.
Oh, let me get the drum kit.
If you're ready with the drum kit, yeah, I think, do you want to get Ringo set up again?
Okay. Right, okay, we're ready? Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4.
And the winner is Edward Kane. Congratulations,
woo-hoo!
Edward!
Woo-hoo! Nice work, Ed. Congratulations.
So Edward will be getting in contact to tell you how you can redeem your prize. And we would love you to send us the cover.
Yeah.
That we can then put on our various social media accounts and to share with the world what actually happens with that. So congratulations, Edward, and thank you so much to everyone else who entered. And remember, if you didn't win, you can still get your 10% off. You go to demonza.com/bestsellerxp and you enter the code bestsellerxp to get 10% off any of their services. Please support our sponsor, it supports our podcast. So and thank you again to Demonza for that incredible prize for our listeners.
Excellent stuff. I just want to explain one thing in the interview of Catherine Brian Howard. You may have noticed that I use the phrase "as rough as a wombat's bum." I just want to clarify that Miranda Dickinson, when I spoke to her, she used that phrase and then she challenged me to get that phrase into the show, into the next interview. So that's why I did that. I just want to clarify that's why. So if you've got any,
I like a challenge.
If you've got any rude phrases you want me to slip into any interviews of mega famous authors, get in touch on social media. We're on Bestseller Experiment on Facebook. We are at Bestseller XP on Twitter and Instagram. And come and see us on the website. You know, we've got a wonderful website. We've got a newsletter, which we occasionally send out. And you can get a free ebook, which is The Vault of Gold, which is transcripts from our first year of interviews. And there's some amazing stuff in there. So come and say hello.
Absolutely. And maybe we should introduce this as a new level for patron supporters, where they can give us something that we have to slip into the show each week. It could get a bit ridiculous. But we do want to say thank you to everyone who's supporting this podcast. We love you very much. Thank you for coming along with us on this journey, especially Sam, who is recovering after 153 hours of binging. And we look forward, as we draw towards the end of this year, to continue to inspire you in 2019 to get that book published. If you are thinking of doing anything with your writing, I want to say, as your coach, this is the time to start thinking about it. Not New Year's Eve, peoples. Don't be doing it when you're drunk at a New Year's Eve party and writing down your New Year's resolutions. Do it now before the craziness of Christmas takes over. Start thinking about over next week, start thinking about what you want to achieve. Write down some goals. And if you want to share them with us, please do make an annual public declaration, maybe for what you want to do next year, because this stuff works, folks. It absolutely works. So thank you, Mr. Stay, for your time today. Great interview, as always. And I look forward, as we both do, to joining you again, same time, same place, next week. So it's a goodbye from Mark 1.
And a goodbye from Mark 2. Goodbye!
Goodbye!